And so with that, I was like, what is more carnival, what is more circus than drag, right? Because drag is this like super affirming, like you can be anything you want, you can create anything you want, and it is beautiful and it is good. And so I took this theory of philosophy and social change, combined it with drag, and crossed it over, did a little flip with it into the church. And that is where Miss Pentecost was born.
Hi, everyone. This is Dana Black.
And this is Chelsea Simon.
Welcome to the Collective Table. It's Dana here. Chelsea and I are excited to welcome you to our new season called What God Looks Like. Over the next few months, we're interviewing individuals from across the United States, engaging in creative and innovative ministry settings. In this episode, Chelsea and I kick it off with Miss Pentecost, the first drag queen in the world to become a certified candidate for ordination within the United Methodist Church. Though she was born and raised in a small town of Illinois, Miss Penny was catapulted into international spotlight due to the power and celebration of her carnivalesque ministry to and alongside LGBTQIA+ individuals. In this conversation, Miss Pentecost shares her transformational story, where she wrestles with institutionalized Christianity, yet despite these struggles, finds the sacred and divine beauty of God was worth pursuing. As she discovers this for herself, she creates space for others to have intentional and authentic conversations around queerness and spirituality. This was such a fun conversation.
So we just wanted to start with, if you could give our audience a little bit about your background. Did you grow up in a faith tradition? And what did that kind of look like as you were growing up?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So no, I didn't start really identifying as religious until my junior year when my first boyfriend at the time invited me to church. But before that, I grew up in a fairly irreligious household. We prayed and things, but it was more like the God is great, let us sing for food, whatever. And it was like, I equate it to like washing your hands. It was just something that we did as a kid, and I had no understanding as why, because that was the most religious thing we did. And yet, I also had like these kind of spiritual moments that would like tie. Like looking back, I see it as like a continuum that brought me to today. So like spiritual moments out in the woods or out fishing with my dad or all of that. And it's just kind of brought me to today.
What was it? You said the first time you went was when you went with your boyfriend. What were you thinking as you went into a church? Like, so you had not been in like really in a church experience before.
No, I had gone to like one church camp thing, summer thing. And so I just thought that all churches were the like youth summer camp thing. And that is not the case. Fun fact. it is not always pirate themed. Yeah. When I first went with my boyfriend, his family made up like 80% of the church. So like I knew it was going to be some sort of kind of good experience, but I was also terrified because I had never been in a church before. And so I was sitting there, I had listened to this incredible sermon, could not tell you what it was now, but we got up afterwards, standing around in a circle, and we're doing the post-church thing of trying to decide where to go for lunch afterwards. We're like, Cracker Barrel or like Mexican food, we'll see. And the pastor had came over and like stood in the middle of this circle and said, listen, I don't know who you are or why you're here. And I was like, oh my God, it's my first day at church and I'm gonna be ran out, just like that. And I like got like cold sweats and I was starting to panic. And then he said, but you right here, right now is enough. And that is all you will ever have to be. And then he did like the awkward like mic drop and walked away.
Wow. And
yeah, it was like a God moment for me. Yeah. And it really secured my thought of spirituality being accessible. Looking back at that moment, I want to be able to create those moments, to be able to tell people that they are enough, whoever, wherever they are. That was my first church experience.
And then you were into church? Like, then you started going kind of on a regular basis, or did it still kind of take you some time to figure all that out?
Yeah, I went every week.
For that, wow.
Every week after that. Mostly, it also was because my boyfriend was there, and it was like a whole, like, hanging out with him. But I felt so, I don't know how to describe it. So seen by the divine, and I was able to start asking questions that I didn't know that I even had about God and about faith. And because I am a nerd, a little nerd at heart, it just became this huge research project that I wanted to figure out. And I just fell in love with it.
So that environment was very open to you being curious, asking questions, trying to understand what is all this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. A big part of my faith is the questions, is being able to raise the question marks and not always finding the answers. And that's hard for me as a nerd. I want to know the answers, but faith is the only place in my life that I feel secure, comfortable enough to not have to have the answers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Were you open with your boyfriend at church? Was it like a affirming congregation?
Yes. So at the time, my boyfriend was not out, but I was out. And I had many meetings with the pastor. I was just the gay friend that hung out at the church with everyone. I had many conversations with the pastor. And that is where one of my first struggles, reconciliatory moments happened, because the pastor told me, look, the same person that said you right here, right now is enough, also told me that I was welcome to sit in the pews, to be a part of the congregation, but I would never be able to seek any sort of leadership or any sort of presence outside of sitting and listening.
How do you reconcile? Like, what does that look like?
At the time, I was just like, I guess this is it. It's the only church I've been to. And it took a lot of me doing my own work of reading different books and going down internet rabbit holes of trying to find a different type of theology that affirms my queerness and, in my experience. So it happened outside of the church that I was able to unpack it.
And so how did you get to where you are today with the church that you're in today, Hope United Methodist?
Yeah. So the first church was a non-denominational church. And I had gone to college and broke up with my boyfriend. Oh, sad day, you know. He got the church. That's okay. I got Bloomington Normal. I just started church shopping for 2 years. I hopped around to different churches, testing them out, and not a single one was affirming, opening, that really vibed with my my theology and my understanding. And then I was at my first drag show in downtown Bloomington at Bloomington's first ever Pride Fest. And I was there with my friends. I was having a great time. And then over the loudspeaker, they said, security provided by the pastors at Hope Church. And I was like, now I have to go to another church because they're supporting me. I've got to go support them. And I showed up that next Sunday. Pride Fest was, I believe, either a Friday or Saturday. I showed up that Sunday. And it was the most welcoming and incredible experiences. I think the first sermon was about unpacking colonialization and gentrification and all of that stuff. And it was like, oh my God, these things can be talked about in a church setting, like by a pastor. And their Hope Church's prayer statement is, we are a place where absolutely everyone can experience God's love. And then the second line is, we are a place of theological thought and conversation. And so they really lean into the idea that that the question marks that have been chasing me through my life are not only welcomed in the space, but they're celebrated.
Mm. Oh, I love that. Right. We don't leave our brains at the door. We keep thinking, questioning and seeking. That's how we grow. Oh, I love that.
I think a big part of our audience are people that are looking for a more progressive church or a more progressive place that they can be in these kind of conversations. What was that like for you trying to attend churches that welcomed your questions, accepted you as you were, you know, not just welcomed you, but affirmed and celebrated who you are? What was that process like? Because I think a lot of our listeners are trying to figure out where that place might be for them. And it sounds like it took you a little bit of time.
It took me a long time. But when I found this congregation, the congregation that affirms, that encourages me, that supports me for all that I am, all of my beautiful queerness, my loud laughter and everything, it was unlike anything I had ever experienced in a church before. It was like a God moment where like everything just felt right. Like a beautiful 70 degree summer day where like there's a slight breeze and everything is just beautiful and perfect and in its place. That is what it felt like to be a part of that congregation.
So it's out there for people.
Yes, it's out there. Oh my gosh, yes. And like what I find really interesting about our church is about a third of our congregation is not within Bloomington Normal. They're from around the world and around the country. And so our online, like especially during COVID, we've only been online this whole year, but a third of our people are from different states.
I wonder, you know, what it does for your faith when you walk into a space and you hear you're loved, you're beloved, you're good enough, you're worthy. And you know what? You can do every single thing in this congregation. You can do whatever you want. You can be a pastor. Yes, you can.
Yes, yes, absolutely. When you can see yourself in the systems and when you can see yourself in the divine, you can start to see the divine in yourself. It's a two-way street. And when you can start to see that, like, I am a reflection of the divine and the church is a reflection of me, then you can become, the options become limitless in that moment.
So for people that are listening, just tuning in, Isaac is the first certified, openly gay certified candidate in your conference. So the Methodist Church is a global denomination that is broken up into conferences, so it's easier to kind of manage. But in your conference, you are the first openly gay candidate to be certified, possibly the first drag candidate in the whole of the United Methodist Church.
In the entire world.
Right. Yeah. As you work towards ordained ministry, so you work to become the leader of a church, and maybe people have heard the Methodist Church is battling that in a lot of ways. And you were telling us a couple of days ago about the battle that exists in your conference. And so I'm wondering if maybe you can just share a little bit about that.
The conference that I'm a part of, the Illinois Great Rivers Conference, is historically a more conservative conference. It leans to the more traditional understandings of scripture when you think of conservatism. And yet, there are pockets of people, of congregations, of church leadership, who are working to shift the conference. And even though I have faced an incredible amount of pushback within my conference, within the US and around the world even, Ben Shapiro was commenting on my drag last week, so that's exciting. But I have received insurmountable amount of love being poured into me by leadership within the conference, by my DS, by my DCOM, my District Committee on Ordained Ministry, and by my church as well. They have stood beside me and said that I am welcome. And I see it as a sign of validation for not only for myself, but for all the queer folks who will come after me and all the queer folks who have paved the way for me to this day because I stand upon their shoulders.
And with that, I mean, you might say, like, you know, we've talked about, we're in the California Pacific Conference, which is, it's a progressive conference. So why choose to stay there versus trying to find a place that, you know, even though the bishop supports you and the other structure, why stay there?
It's because this is my home. I've grown up here. I fell in love with faith here. I fell in love with Methodism here. I have been ran out of houses before, out of churches before, and I refuse to be chased out of this house of Methodism, this house of God anymore. I will not be bullied into submission. I will not be silenced. Because I have received so much support that I feel like if I were to walk away right now, I would not be doing justice to my own faith, to the people who have kind of propped me up, and to the people who look to me as an example.
And I think that reminded me, we talked about this as well before, but there was a quote, and I think it was in the Sojourner article. And you said, what if we turned our limits into starting points? And I'd love for you to share what that meant for you, because I thought it was just a beautiful context.
Oh my gosh, yeah. We are told, as just people in general, but especially queer folks of color, are told where they can go, like where I as a queer man can speak, where I as a queer man can stand, where I as a queer man can volunteer and everything. And those limits are put on us without foundation, because my faith says that there is not a limit. The divine, the holy source of equity does not have limits for us. And so one of the things that I have been leaning into is this idea that my limits up until today are now a starting point, because it's time to be pushing the boundaries, to be pushing past that. And I think there's going to be incredible growth there. And incredible possibilities.
You know, so much of me wants to say to you, come to CalPAC because I like you and I want you to be next, like I want to hang out with you, but also like there's a protection, like I want to protect you. And it just reminds me of how much courage that takes to be the first and to, I mean, you're recognizing you're standing on the shoulders of those that came before you, but in so many ways, you're the first in your conference. You're setting an example for those, and how much courage that really takes. And your courage is going to give other people courage. The ways that you are living out your call, your clear call to ministry, are going to be able to give other people the courage to do that as well. And so I just want to affirm that in you. I think that's just such an amazing thing to lean into, where so many of us, you know, shy away from, protect ourselves, to put yourself out there and say, here I am, this is who I am, is just going to allow other people to do that too.
Absolutely. And like, to be honest and transparent, it's not always rainbows and butterflies for me. It is hard. I have cried a lot. I have received threats. We've made police reports. There has been calls for God to smite this entire congregation. And I just keep leaning into the story of Esther in the sense that Esther was a woman who was incredible and had incredible privilege. And in a moment where she was able to put her gusto to the test, she utilized that privilege to make change happen. the idea that perhaps you were born for a day such as this.
Yeah, and I've seen some of the responses that you get on social media, some of the really negative. And I just have to say, I'm so impressed. Like, you just respond with love on love on love. And it's just, I mean, the example of like, love your enemies and those who persecute you. I mean, it's such a message to those people as well, that it doesn't matter, you know, the example of God that you are being to those people also, even though.
Yeah, even though I want to be snarky and sarcastic, I'm sure, and sassy, I just, if I am created in the image of God, so yeah, are you. Dang it.
Yes, dang it. Right, that's right. Yeah.
One of the things you're reminding me of is I was talking about the word Christian, and Christian is a noun, but it can also be an adjective and it can also be a verb. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you are, your actions, the way you articulate and care for people and show compassion and love, like, you're living it. Like, you are an example. And so, like, that's a Christian right there in action. You're now adjective and verb all wrapped up.
Thank you. Oh, that makes me so happy. You're a poor judge of character, but
No,
thank you. That really means a lot.
So in your article, you talk about carnival culture. Can you share more about that and how and what that meant for you and how you learned about it?
So it all started with research at my undergrad at Illinois Wesleyan, because as I mentioned before, I am what? A nerd. Yes. All right, here we go. But it all began with this like paper on religious studies methods. And we were looking at different philosophers and all these different like old dead people now. And one of the people was Mikhail Bakhtin, this old Russian philosopher from the early 19th century. And he had this theory called the carnivalesque and the grotesque, this idea that systems can be changed through laughter and joy and through holding on to power for longer than what it was meant for. And for the people listening at home who are like, okay, you just said a lot. Think of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the Disney movie, where Quasimodo is crowned this king of fools in this festival. And he is this social outcast who shouldn't have any power 364 days of the year. And through the story and holding on to that power and leaning into, yes, this is who I am. Yes, I deserve life. Yes, I deserve to be celebrated. Systems were able to be changed and growth was able to happen. And so this philosopher thought that if we were to hold on to the power more than just you're allowed to sit in a pew, if you're able to say, yes, I am, and also I can be in leadership and do it in such a public, joy-filled way, then that is one of the best ways to change systems. And so with that, I was like, what is more carnival, what is more circus than drag, right? Because drag is this like super affirming, like you can be anything you want, you can create anything you want, and it is beautiful and it is good. And so I took this theory of philosophy and social change, combined it with drag, and crossed it over, did a little flip with it into the church. And that is where Miss Pentecost was born.
When I think about drag, like going to a drag show, or I just think about creativity on steroids, like just like explosion of creativity. I think you could describe it as an extension of yourself. So how did all that come together for you?
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, drag in itself is this art form. It's this beautiful art form that is born from people saying that you can't be something. And so it means something different for every single person, for every single drag artist. But for me, it is about being everything that I was told I couldn't be and everything that I know I can be. And with this idea of the carnivalesque, the 1960s church lady is kind of the epitome of what faith is in America. Okay. This like over the top, like, big hair, higher the hair, closer to God, praise Jesus, bless your heart. And so for me, I was told that I could not be a part of this system. And so I claimed this epitome of what faith is, and I made it for myself. And so I crafted this persona that is just an unapologetic affirmation of queer identity and queer faith experience. And then my name, Miss Penny Cost, is a pun because I am a nerd, but I'm also like secretly a 90-year-old dad and just love dad jokes. But Pentecost is based on the idea of Pentecost, this idea that after the crucifixion of Christ, all the followers like locked themselves in the room where the Last Supper happened. They were like, what is going to happen next? Like, what can we do? Then the Holy Spirit came down and dwelled with them. It is said through tongues of fire, and it gave them the ability to go out into the world and speak in new ways to new people. And in the Bible, it was through different languages. For me, my different language is the language of drag and the language of queer artistry. So I really see a modern twist on the biblical account of Pentecost happening within drag spaces.
And I think one of the things I love is that you took something that has this kind of old, kind of cringy feel to it, with we think of the church lady. You're at, like, I think about my nana, right? And I'm like, okay, didn't drink, wanted me to play the organ and have hymns, okay? Like, and then you take that and you make it positive. Like the whole element of it is positive, and it just flips it all around and recreates something that is beautiful.
Yeah, as the great Missy Elliott once said, I put my thing down, flip it, and reverse it. No, yeah, that's the thing, is that carnival, the idea of carnival is just taking everything and just flipping it on end. So taking things that were used to beat people into submission and use it to elevate them in return.
It's very Jesus-y, the flipping the world on its head, you know, like that. Oh, I mean, every time I read about Jesus, it's like, well, that's not how I would have done it, because he just has this way of thinking that was so countercultural, and that's exactly what you're naming now. It's like, how do we flip everything, you know, and how do we make it more inclusive? Everyone has dignity and worth and talent and gift and should be celebrated. So it's very Jesus-y also. I don't want to ask a naive question, but I'm wondering, what does it feel like to be Miss Pentecost?
That is a beautiful question. Oh my goodness. When I am Miss Penny, I have this confidence, this knowledge of like nothing can tear me down. Nothing can separate me from the divine. It's just the hyperbole of everything just comes into being. And I don't know, like, I am able to have conversations that I wouldn't have outside of drag, like conversations of faith. Like, before drag, I would not talk about faith with random people. But because of this, like, everything that I am, people are like, hey, this is what I heard. You want to talk about that? And then I become like a makeshift pastor in a basement of a gay bar. And so it feels like just a complete affirmation of who I am. And not like a separate thing from Isaac, from the person I am from 9 to 5 or from day to day, but as an extension of myself.
So I hear that Miss Pentecost, she has allowed you to really open up your faith and talk to people about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, that comes from like, if you're going to be having conversations with people about what you believe, you have to know what you believe. You have to know where you stand in order to understand where someone else stands, and to have a conversation across that divide. And drag has allowed me the space, the mental space, the spiritual space to really be able to unpack and articulate my faith.
And I remember you talking about learning about other people's stories. Does this create space for you to do that? Do you feel like that's been something that's been ongoing for you? And how has that helped articulate or create or craft your faith, your own faith?
Oh my God, yeah. We are all walking libraries of these stories that we're just waiting for someone to engage with. That we're just waiting for someone to be like, hey, tell me about that time that you blah, blah, blah. And there is such joy in storytelling and hearing and receiving stories. It's what I think it's a divine moment, and I think it's a beautiful moment. And for me, I come from a background of interfaith experience, because before I was like, super religious, became a Methodist. I was in interfaith spaces where we would have Muslims and Baha'is and Jewish people and like people of, and atheists and agnostics and people. Our faith was not an issue. It was a starting point for a conversation towards a better tomorrow. And because of that background, I see so much validity and beauty in every single person's own spiritual place in life, whether or not you're Christian, whether or not you're Methodist. The stories that have brought you to this moment, to today, to listening to some queen on a podcast, are good, and they are worth sharing with the world, because there is so much knowledge to be learned from.
Yeah. And I think that especially in certain, you know, conservative spaces with Christian thought, there's this idea like, oh, if you hear other stories, or if you learn about other faiths, or if you don't know, you know, if you deviate at all from this belief structure, it's going to somehow, your faith is going to deteriorate. And yet I have found in my experience that it only grows stronger and gets deeper. And yes, your perspective grows, and you really see how expansive God is.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Eboo Patel, who is the like founder of the interfaith, of like major interfaith movements in the United States, says that the same stones that bridge or that build bridges of compassion can be used as bludgeons of oppression. And the stones that we carry that can like build our faith up can also be used as weapons. And so we have a choice as Christians, as Methodists, as people walking the earth, whether or not we're going to use what stone we have, whether or not we're going to use it to build a bridge, or whether we're going to use it to pummel someone.
Going back to drag and using that in your ministry and the ministry experience, how does that connect for you from a spiritual formation perspective? Because just share with us how that experience has deepened your spiritual identity and how you've used that process.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, there is the spirituality of drag begins with painting my face. It takes, you know, between 3 and 4 hours to get ready. And so I spend a lot of time with just myself, with just a mirror, looking at what God has created. For better or for worse, there I am. And it is a process that I have done hundreds of times. And even though it's different every time, I am able to tap into a lower brain moment. I don't know, the psychologists say like for meditation, you go into a lower state of thinking and you're able to really dwell upon different topics. So when when I'm painting my face, I often think about how the divine is moving around, like moving in my life around me. I think about my ancestors, quote unquote, my queer ancestors who have brought me to this day. I dream about the future of the church that could happen, or I meditate upon scripture. Yeah, so that is one aspect of it. Another aspect of drag, an intersection of drag and spirituality, is I pray the rosary a lot, the Holy Catholic Rosary. And I have done it in drag on Facebook. And for me, I was just sharing one of my spiritual practices, teaching folks like how to pray the rosary, like why has been around for thousands of years and what things we can take away from it. And for me to do it in an inclusive way, and I like to say it's a reformed rosary, because I change up some of the language in order to better connect with God. That way it keeps some of the stumbling blocks and barriers away. So that is kind of some of the spiritual practices that I have with drag.
And I love that you share them, because I do think doing ministry work, oftentimes you have people in your congregation, people who you do studies with, and they'll say, well, what kind of spiritual practice should we engage with? You know, what should we do? So the fact that you're giving examples and talking about it, I think it connects people to it.
Absolutely. What's really funny is I have this like discomfort with the term evangelist, as many people do. And there have been some of my friends, queer leaders, who call me the drag evangelist. And I'm like, ah, really? Yeah. But also there's been high ups. Like when one of my videos of me praying the rosary in drag went slightly viral, and my bishop and leaders of my conference instantly began receiving phone calls calling for a revocation of my candidacy, a revote, and lots of things. And there is a person high up in my conference who watched the video and said, I don't know what people are mad about. This is a person teaching people how to pray. And I was like, yes, yes, yes. We all have these toolboxes of prayer, of spiritual practices that can be shared. And I hope that's what I do, is I share different pathways, different practices towards spirituality. Yeah.
And it went viral. I mean, you're teaching people that would have never maybe even heard of the rosary before.
Yeah.
One of the things you said is when you were doing the spiritual practice of putting on Miss Pentecost, you imagine what the church might be like. And I'm wondering if, you know, as you look to the future, if you could just, you know, throw everything out, like what do you think the church could look like in your greatest imagination?
I dream of a day in which there will never be a question of whether or not any individual walking through the door, any individual walks through the door, I dream of a day where they don't have to question whether or not they're welcome, whether it's because of the languages that they speak, whether it's because of their citizenship status, the color of their skin. I want a place in which the kingdom of God can be lived out in utter affirmation of life, and in a way where people can experience the divine who were told they were never allowed to.
Yeah, just what I hear and what I see is what the church should be, which is everything that the secular society is, where it tells people, no, you can't do this. No, you can't. If you want to be this person, you have to have this degree, or you have to have this training, or no, you can't work here. Where the church should be a space where everybody can come in. And it does not matter. And there is just love and grace and welcome. And that's just that it has to be different than the outside world.
By being who you are and being who you are in a public space and a place where it might not be the easiest, you are ushering in that kingdom, and it's going to allow other people to join you in the creation of what you just named, what the church is, what God intended for us to live together despite our differences, and to celebrate those differences. I get a little teary-eyed.
I'm a crier too, so.
But I see that in when you're speaking, and the ways in which you are able to reach to a population who thought that they were forgotten, and to stand in that space and say, I've stood in the same space you have. I have felt like this wasn't a place for me, or it wasn't a place for my full self. For you to do that automatically gives them the knowledge that they can too. And that's just so powerful. That just, I just powerful.
Evangelism has is always been a scary word in the United Methodist Church. Do you ever see yourself reclaiming that word?
I don't know. I used to think that I wouldn't start claiming the word queerness, because like queer was used as a label that caused harm, and evangelist is a label that causes harm. so maybe it will take a reclamation of the term evangelist and the act of evangelizing, quote unquote, in order for it to be made healthy and whole again. So I don't know, maybe I will start claiming that.
Well, I feel like we're friends already, so we're virtual hugging and yeah, keeping you in prayer, but we're excited to see what's in the future. So Isaac, thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll be in touch. Take care.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. Just like everyone we are interviewing throughout this series reflects the sacred and holy image of God, so do you. Together, we are what God looks like.
The Collective Table is supported by San Diego United Methodist Church in Encinitas, California.
A big thank you to the team at Castos, especially our producer Stuart Barefoot and our content editor Claire Watson.
The original music heard in this episode was created and performed by Mystic Mercy.
Make sure to subscribe to the podcast, YouTube channel, and our newsletter.
If you'd like to financially support the work of The Collective Table, please visit thecollectivetable.org. There you can also find out more about who we are and view past episodes.